Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Yes, and a warm welcome. This is Judaism 101.9 with Rabbi Michael Katz. We are here with you every Thursday, just after 11. It's a privilege to be with you. It's a privilege to be able to talk to you and to share some thoughts. And of course, what we deal with on Judaism 101.9 is the basics of Judaism and some of the interesting facts about the times that we're in, the period of the Jewish calendar, things that have happened in the past and things that we need to reflect on and that seem to be recurring, keep on recurring all the time. And one can be forgiven for asking the question about where it all leads. Where does this all go to? And what is the end game? And of course, as we hear these things and we go through them, it is perhaps the biggest push and the biggest invitation for us all to think seriously about how we really need Mashiach, how we really need the Geula, the redemption, which we are promised will end this whole cycle of difficulties, problems, and issues that we have had. And when we come to this week, which is today, the 6th of Iyar, going through until next week, Wednesday, if we look back in history, well, it's talk about history repeating itself. It is seems to be telling the same story, just kind of changed the places, changed the dates, and the story carries on. The difficulties for Jews, the anti-Semitism, the persecutions, the kind of running from pillar to post. And yet each one of them is a building block for redemption. Each one of them, if we think about it, the time that we spent in Egypt before we got out of Mitzrayim, before we got out of Egypt, there were many, many steps. It wouldn't have been as powerful, as important, as noticeable, and as much of a lesson had we not had the difficulties. Now, that doesn't mean that we want these difficulties. It doesn't mean that we want the pain and the suffering and the persecution. But it does mean that we recognize that this is all part of a greater plan, some of which we really have no clue about. We don't understand at all. And yet, as we look at them, we start seeing the emerging pattern. And let's have a look at some of the things in Jewish history that happened during this period of time. Well, the 6th of Iyar, if we were to go back to 1881, what would be happening today? 1881, on the 6th of Iyar. This, let's look at Russia. So it was following the assassination a month earlier of Tsar Alexander II of Russia, and there were rumors that the Jews were behind the assassination. And so anti-Jewish riots broke out on the 6th of Iyar. Riots, 1881, anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, blaming the Jews for the assassination of Tsar Alexander II. These riots lasted, hear it, for 4 years. And during that time, thousands of Jewish homes and synagogues were destroyed. Countless Jews were injured and impoverished. And unrest started out in southern Russia and then quickly spread throughout the whole country. Now, Tsar Alexander III, the successor, actually blamed the riots on the Jews and punished them by enacting new laws which further restricted their freedoms. Could you imagine? Doesn't it sound familiar? We are the cause and the reason. The riots began against the Jews for ostensibly their involvement in the assassination, and it is then blamed on them that they were the ones who conjured up and actually made these riots. And among these laws that were then instituted under Tsar Alexander III were devastating laws where legislation that restricted Jews from residing in towns with fewer than 10,000 citizens, limiting their professional employment and educational opportunities. And they were known as the May Laws. Now, we know coming close to May, and that big name, May Day, and so on, but the May Laws compelled many Jews to emigrate. It says that it actually caused up to 2 million Jews to leave Russia, many of them opting then to emigrate to the United States, where they were looking for the freedoms that the USA offered to people always. We've got to remember that this is also the day on which the actual War of Independence broke out in Israel. You know, 1948, while yesterday people celebrated the 78th birthday of Israel, of the State of Israel, here we have the War of Independence that broke out. Now, this wasn't a war that resulted in independence. It was the war that that was the result of the proclamation of independence in 1948. Because on the very next day, could you imagine? One day we were celebrating the independence of Israel, and the very next day, the Arab nations surrounding Israel, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, all declared war on the new state of Israel. And the object was to drive the Jews into the sea. It was on that day that Tel Aviv was actually bombed, and it is absolutely no news to that part of the world that this is what happens. If we reflect forward, and here is a glimmer of hope. It's on the 7th of Iyar. In 335 before the Common Era, the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem was celebrated with great jubilation. It was nearly 88 years after they were destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. And this all happened on the 7th of Iyar. But if we take a look at what else is on the 7th of Iyar, the 7th of Iyar in 1516, the Venetian City Council declared that all Jews were to be segregated into a specific area of the city. This is where the name ghetto actually came from. Yeah, it sounds kind of Italian. It was from Venice, and Venice's ghetto was surrounded by water with a canal leading to its gates. At night, the Christian guards patrolled the waters around the ghetto to ensure that the night curfew wasn't violated. At the same time of the establishment of this ghetto, numerous other degrading laws were enacted, including the requirement that all Jews wear yellow stars as identification. Yeah, the Nazis didn't invent the yellow stars. It goes all the way back to 1516. And despite these restrictions, the Jewish community blossomed and it functioned normally. And in 1797, the ghetto was abolished by Napoleon during the French Revolution. The site chosen to accommodate the Jews had once housed the city's foundries, ghettos in Italian, and thus the eventual popularization throughout Europe of the word ghetto to describe the city sections where Jews were forced to reside. Isn't that amazing? So that is actually where the name ghetto came from, and all the way back to 1516. If we go to the 8th of Iyar, it sounds like we're reading through a series of really, really nasty stories. Well, the First Crusade began in 1096. In the year 1070, the Muslim Turks commenced an offensive against the Christian pilgrims in Jerusalem. Pope Gregory VII offered his help to defend the Greek Christians, but the army he promised never materialized. In 1095, his successor, Pope Urban II, began a call for a holy war to liberate the Christians in Jerusalem. And by the next year, more than 100,000 men had rallied to his call, and that was known as the First Crusade. Urban and the local clergymen in Europe felt that the crusade had another purpose as well. And this was, and it became, the more dominant purpose, actually, of the crusades. And what was that? It was to annihilate any non-Christians who happened to be in Europe and who refused to convert to Christianity. And of course, who was target number one? Who were walking around not with the yellow stars, but actually with a target on their backs or fronts or wherever, was the Jewish community. And on their way to the Holy Land, the mobs of crusaders attacked many, many Jewish communities. On Shabbat, the 8th of Iyar, the Jews of Speyer in the Rhineland, Germany, were massacred. And many of the Jews of Worms in Germany were also massacred on this day. Some of them took refuge in a local castle for a week before being slaughtered as they davened Shacharit, as they were saying their morning prayers on that fateful day. And this, of course, is the legacy of these things that is taught in history as the wonderful Crusades.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi and welcome back. This is Rabbi Michael Katz with Judaism 101.9, and you're probably asking why we played music. Judaism 101.9 subscribes to the rules, of course, of the fact that during this period of time we do not play live music and we don't play instrumental music. We should be playing, if we're playing music at all, we should be playing a cappella music, which is just human voices. We do apologize. The playlist of the radio show is pre-done and came as much as a surprise to me as it did possibly to you. But please note, we are not disregarding some of these rules and regulations, of course, and customs that people have. We hope you don't take any offense. Hopefully it'll be corrected. And we look forward to your participation and your listening and making sure that it complies with the standards that we are trying to upkeep here as well. So an apology from us for that. And we do look forward to being able to better serve you and do the things that are correct in terms of halacha, Jewish law, and Jewish practice. Now, if we look forward to Sunday, the 9th of Iyar, and Sunday, the 9th of Iyar, have something very, very interesting to share with you. The Sunday, the 9th of Iyar, it's on this day in 5594 that an event took place which was quite astounding, because it was on the 9th of Iyar, in 1834, that there was great celebration in the court of Lubavitch. In Chabad, the followers of Rabbi Menachem Mendel, the Tzemach Tzedek of Lubavitch, had a child, a son, his seventh son, child was born to the beloved Rebbe, and many of the Hasidim who had come for Pesach to Lubavitch, to be together with the Rebbe, they decided to stay on for the bris, for this circumcision that was scheduled for the 9th of Iyar. So, yeah, in those days, you know, a couple of weeks, 3-4 weeks after Pesach. So, of course, if the Rebbe's son is going to have a bris, could you imagine the celebration in town? It was going to be scheduled for the 9th of Iyar, the 8th day after the child was born. Now, it was early in the morning of the appointed day, which was the 9th of Iyar. Everybody was ready for the bris, the tables were set, the chassidim were assembled, and the moel had laid out his instruments ready to do the bris, and everybody awaited the appearance of the Rebbe. Rebbe Menachem Mendel, who was known as the Tzemach Tzedek, and the Rebbe's door remained closed. And at first, okay, you know, the Rebbe's a few minutes late, and then it became an hour, and then it became another hour. And then the chassidim began to wonder if perhaps the bris was postponed. And soon word came out from the Rebbe that the bris would be held today, but nothing else was said. The morning hours passed. It got later in the day. It was better part of the afternoon was already gone. And late in the afternoon, the Rebbe actually came out of his room and instructed that the bris should commence. And the only thing that he said was something really mysterious. He said, I, the Polotsk Chevra Kedisha, the burial society of Polotsk, and nobody knew what he was talking about. And then another strange mystery. When the bris took place, this the Rebbe named the little boy, the child, Shmuel. And Chassidim was startled, because nobody knew of a Shmuel in the lineage and the heritage and the family. Where all of a sudden did this name Shmuel come from? And when one of Rabbi Menachem Mendel's older children asked his father after whom the child was made, so another child says, Dad, Tati, who's he named after? His father said, a water carrier from Polotsk. That was his reply. Now, amongst many people who were at the bris, there were people who had come from Polotsk, and they started to investigate when they got home. It turned out that on the day of the bris, two people in Polotsk had unfortunately passed away, and the Chevra Kedisha had spent the majority of their time, effort, and energy in taking care of the burial of the one and kind of ignored the other. And why? The one who they really looked after, was a wealthy, well-to-do man who had great influence in the town. And everybody was running there and running circles around, making sure that everything was taken care of. The other one was a simple water carrier, simple man who carried the water, and he was kind of ignored. Late in the day, the Cherekadisha quickly went and did whatever they needed to do, the tara and the preparation and the actual burial, which took place late in that afternoon. Now, one of the Hasidim noted that the Zohar points out that we can only name, or should only name a child after someone who has departed if the burial has taken place. And it seems that the Rebbe delayed the bris so that he could name his youngest child an ultimate successor, because the Rebbe Reb Shmuel became the next Rebbe of Chabad. Although he was the youngest son, he became the Rebbe, and he was named after the water carrier of Polotsk. It's a fascinating story. It teaches us a tremendous amount about how we have to think about things of elevation of some people over the others, the need to take care of those who may be downcast, the need to look after everybody and anybody, and not necessarily only those who are our favorites or those who have money, etc. And the Rebbe decided to name his son after this water carrier. Fascinating thing that he held on until the levaya, until the funeral had taken place, and it was delayed because of this. Yeah, there is so much mystical and so many things to think about in terms of this fascinating story. But the water carrier of Polotsk passed away in 1834 on this particular day. Could you imagine that was a celebrated person to the extent that the Rebbe named his son after him? Now, we have so many people who throughout the history, and particularly history of Hasidism and so on, who were hidden tzaddikim, who were people who were hidden righteous people, and perhaps just a suggestion that Reb Shmuel, the water carrier of Polotsk, was just one of those. Now, if we go forward then to Monday, the 10th of Iyar, it was the anniversary of the passing of Eli, the high priest, who died upon learning that the Holy Ark containing the tablets was captured by the Philistines and that his two sons were killed in battle. Eli was the 13th in the line of the Shoftim, led the Jewish people during the four centuries between the passing of Yeshua and the crowning of King Saul in 879 before the Common Era. In 1510, on the 11th of Iyar, 1,500 Jewish books were confiscated in Frankfurt on Main and Germany at the instigation of an apostate, the Meshumad, and this happened on the 11th of Iyar. And so it keeps on going, all sorts of difficulties that Jews confronted and faced around the world, but sprinkled in between the birth and the bris of Reb Shmuel of Lubavitch, the idea of the walls of Yerushalayim being rebuilt and so on. And so there is always this pattern of exile and redemption. There is always this pattern of difficulty and salvation. There is always this pattern of issues and problems, downcastness, darkness, but then, of course, the light, the dawn and the light and the rising of the sun and a brand new and a beautiful day. And when we think about the history of Jews and Judaism, is this not exactly what continually happens throughout our history, throughout our lives, and will be, please God, in the future? And there comes a time when Jews say, hey, but, you know, we've kind of had enough. It's been a diaspora, a darkness, a golus, an exile that has gone on for far too long. And how much longer do we have to wait until that will end, until there will be a permanent redemption, until there will be an ultimate geula, where no longer will we have to put up with anti-Semitism, with lies, with fake news, with complete sheker, with complete and absolute lies, and instigations that fly in our face, whether it is with protests or flags or attacks on shuls, etc. Whatever it is that these troublemakers and nasty people out there throw at us, it has been something that has gone on for absolute centuries. It has always been part of our system, and the Jews kind of don't know any different. And just when you think it's all gone away and where everything is now so strong and wonderful, it keeps on rearing its ugly head. Yes, of course, we have Israel, and of course, we have the ability now to fight back and to make sure that Jews stand proud and so on. But when will this all end? And we're promised that Mashiach will come. Mashiach will come. There will be a time when there will be peace on earth, where there will be no more war, where swords will be turned into plowshares, where we will have an absolute and ultimate redemption, where there will be a time when not only sanity will prevail, but goodness will prevail, where the dominance of goodness will prevail over everything else, and everybody and anybody will join in, and there'll be no, absolutely no more war, and absolutely no more no more difficulties, no more lies, no more anti-Semitism, none of this. And we hope and we pray that that all happens very, very speedily. Now, this is, as Maimonides lists it, one of the principles of faith. You know, Judaism has many principles of faith. In fact, he lists 13. You know, when you go to shul and at the end of, usually on Friday night, you have Yigdal, the Yigdal prayer actually has 13 verses in it, and it is really a poem, a song, a hymn that was composed and actually talks about the 13 principles of faith, according to the Rambam, according to Maimonides. One of the principles of faith is, I believe with a perfect faith, in the coming of Mashiach, in the fact that Mashiach will come. Yeah, another one separate from that is also the belief in the resurrection of the dead. Yeah, as much as these things seem to be far away from us and they seem to be difficult for us to get our heads around, no, they are actual principles of our faith. We know and we understand, and this, of course, in Judaism 101.9 is a message to you. Belief in Mashiach is not just for those who look at themselves or are perhaps more religious or more involved, or the guys who daven every day, or the people who are in shul all the time and so on. Belief in Mashiach is a principle of Jewish faith, absolute principle. And the idea of the resurrection of the dead, now, it is something that is hard for us to get our heads around. But then, and I'm having a personal discussion recently with a non-Jewish doctor, and the idea of how intricate and involved and complicated and miraculous and unbelievable the workings of the human being, of the human body, actually are, it's absolutely incredible. The formation of cells, the way that the cells mutate, the way that the cells behave, all of these things. And his statement to me was, only God could have created this. And if God could create all of these things, which really we do not understand how they work and how they flourish and how they are and how miraculous they actually are. So God certainly can bring life from absolutely nothing. He can create everything ex nihilo, as it's called, from absolute nothing. So why is there a difficulty then to think about the fact that there will be the resurrection of the dead? If God can create something from nothing, surely he can bring the dead back to life. And this is something that is part and parcel of Judaism. It is imperative that we understand that. The belief in Mashiach, absolutely intrinsic to Judaism, and it's something, of course, that we need more and more each and every day. When we look at our world, it is something that we hope and pray for. And please God, may it come really, really soon.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi and welcome back. Yes, this is Rabbi Michael Katz. We are on Judaism 101.9 and we are in your company, and we are speaking about things that pertain to our lives as Jews during this period of time. And of course, the greatest overlay of the time, and we mentioned it briefly because of the music earlier on, is that we are in the Sfira period. Now, I mentioned it before, the Sfira period was given a little bit of a bad name, in inverted commas, by the fact that something terrible happened to Jews and Judaism during this period of time. It was not the original idea of what this period of time is actually all about. Most of it has to do with the fact that we are looking forward, of course, to Shavuot and the idea of counting the days, of getting closer and closer, and at the same time brushing up on ourselves, making sure that we are cleansed of all the impurities that we have, that we are fixed up, that we are behaving in ways and doing things that are perfect and wonderful and good and positive, fixing up all our, in inverted commas, black holes, our difficulties, getting ever closer to Matan Torah Tenu, to the time of the giving of the Torah on Shavuot. But at the same time, we think about the overlay of the tragedy that befell the students of Rabbi Akiva, 24,000 students who died. And it's an amazing and a fascinating story that these were the students of nobody other than Rabbi Akiva, who taught absolute love for your fellow man. Ahavat Yisrael. That was what Rabbi Akiva taught. We know it's one of the primary kind of statements of love for our fellow man, where we talk about Rabbi Akiva Omer. Rabbi Akiva said, Ze klal gadol batorah. We talk about mitzvahs that are particular and mitzvahs that are kind of all-encompassing. And this is an all-encompassing kind of a mitzvah. The love of your fellow man, all-encompassing, because there are so many things that one needs to be involved in and can be involved in order to demonstrate this. Now, if he was the greatest teacher of Ahavat Yisrael, of the love of your fellow man as yourself, and the kind of due respect that one has to afford and accord to others, how was it that it then happened that his students perished in this terrible plague, 24,000 of them, in the period of time between Pesach and Shavuot that overlaid the time of the Sfirat HaOmer? And it's the reason why today we have a semi-mourning period. During this time, we don't listen to music and we don't have weddings and so on. Well, Rabbi Akiva himself said that it was because Einam Nosnu Kovod Zeh. They didn't show the required respect for each other. They didn't show enough honor to each other, his students. And this is why they died. Now, pretty harsh statement that the students of Rabbi Akiva died because they didn't show enough respect to each other. But what was this all about? The students of Rabbi Akiva, who had as their, if you're a student of Rabbi Akiva, surely you do what he wanted. And he wanted Ahavas Yisrael. He wanted the love of one for the other and of your fellow man more than anything else. And he emphasized it. It was like his main statement, his main credo, the main motto by which he lived. Surely he taught that. Surely that got through to his students. If you want to call yourself a student of it, surely it's only when you keep it. Well, the one thing that was well known about Rabbi Akiva, actually, was that he was an absolute, let's call it a fanatic for things of a Jewish nature. And in fact, dying as he did at the hands of the Romans, Rabbi Akiva was asked by his students, like, what now? You are being killed. You're being murdered for the fact that you are keeping to the Torah and your mitzvahs and have stood up against the Romans in this incredible fashion with a strength and a resistance like no other, with an absolute commitment. Rabbi Akiva died stating that at last I have the opportunity to really say the Shema Yisrael, to really die with that on my lips and know that I have done the idea of giving b'chol nafshecha, that I'm prepared to give my absolute life for God. This is a rare opportunity, and I've had this opportunity now. Can you imagine? That was the thought process, that was what he was going through, that absolute commitment. But the one thing that Rabbi Akiva was emphasizing was that his students had that fanaticism. But fanaticism sometimes, and the absolute commitment, which is very often a great, great attribute, but it needs to be couched with, it needs to have the requisite amount of respect for your fellow men. And that was where perhaps his students failed, not showing enough of that respect through the fanaticism. Now, we all know the fanatics. We all know the people who want to change the world, who want to change us, who come on heavy and tell us that out of the goodness of their hearts, for love of us, that we should do this, that we should do that, that we need to behave in a certain fashion, that we need to be a little bit more observant, that we should make sure that we keep to our mitzvahs and so on. We need all of that. Yeah, wonderful. But there has to be the required respect for the individual. And the required respect for the individual person, for their thoughts, for the things that they, the way that they see things, for their opinions and so on. Not to be influenced by it necessarily, but within your incredible commitment and fanaticism in trying to change the world and make everybody a lot more religious, a lot frumer, a lot closer to God, we need to also make sure that we have the requisite respect for their own individual privacy, for their own individual thoughts, for their own individual opinions. And without that, we can end up in disaster. Be back with you right after this.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
So yes, we are proudly presenting a beautiful campaign, which you just heard the ad for, loveyourfellow.com. And if you go there and you check it out, well, there is so much to learn and so many things that we could think about and integrate into our own lives about and around the idea of Avas Yisrael, about loving our fellow man, about making sure that we take care of and we think about and we are aware of the needs of others. It's not only their needs in a personal kind of a way or in a practical kind of a way or in a physical kind of a way, but the needs of encouragement and the needs of direction and the needs of help when people are crying out for help. And it may not be a cry where they come directly to you and they actually break down and cry and say, I need help in this area. But to be able to recognize when somebody else is in pain, when somebody else is suffering, when somebody else is uncomfortable. This is all part of this incredible program. And there's so much to learn and to be learnt and to be thought about and to take on board. And it is, yes, a required shift in attitude. And one of the first shifts is to give ourselves the space to look at these things, see what our sages taught, what our Torah teaches, and the things that we need to think about and follow in order to make this all actually come to fruition in our own lives. So hopefully we'll be successful and we will bring about the incredible Avas Yisrael, because it is the forerunner to the coming of Mashiach. It is a prerequisite. It is something that we know we can do and we need to do any time. That the Jewish people have been divided, so our enemies spot the Achilles heel, and that's what they go for, and it brings about the downfall of that time and of that period and so on. When we are strong and we stand together and when we are one and united and when we have respect for each other, well, that ultimately brings respect from the outside as well. And hopefully this is something that we can master and we can do and ultimately bring about the Geula, the ultimate redemption. So I want to wish you a great rest of the week, a great Shabbos up ahead, a beautiful week until we meet again, please God, next week in another exciting episode of Judaism 101.9.